Take me where the promised land are green.
It's 7 AAB. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday 8 p.m. Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual and our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org will hear our speaker. We believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight's speaker is Don T. from Gainesville, Georgia. We go to meetings a lot together, and today I got the news that our scheduled speaker was stuck in Biloxi, Mississippi with a stomach virus. Wasn't going to be able to make it tonight. So I just threw it out there in the men's 9 a.m. meeting. I said, you too can be the guest of honor at the NABA Club tonight. Boy, Don stepped up. Now, he's in the midst of surgery on his right knee, I guess. He's got a cast from his hip to his ankle. And he said, if you'll drive me in my car, it's a big old GMC SUV. He said, I'll do it. I'm like, done deal. So I'm truly grateful to Don for that. And here he is, Don T. Thank you.
I'm an alcoholic, Don T. Born in 1946 in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada. That's where Montana and North Dakota come together, 100 miles north of there. Grew up on a wheat farm. Started drinking occasionally in the ninth grade, and it kept getting, more so as time went on, like many of us. My parents grew up in the Depression. My mother was a single divorced woman in the 30s, raising a daughter by herself. My father wouldn't marry her while the war was on. When the war was, because he was a farmer, and he also had bad feet. As soon as the war was over, they got married, and I was born about 10 and a half months later, so I am on the very leading edge of the baby boomers, and for what that means. I grew up, as I said, on a farm as an only child. Actually, I had a half-sister, but she was gone by the time I was cognizant of life, and very lonely growing up. Dogs were my only friends, and so when I took that first drink of alcohol, man, I started having friends all over the place. Some imagined, maybe, and some real, and most of them fair weather, I suppose. Often joke that I think I was raised by wolves, just to tell you how unsocialized I was. I went to the first grade, and I skipped kindergarten because of the school bus situation and going to city schools and what have you. And they're taking attendance the first day, and they're going down Mary, and Mary puts up her hand. Jimmy puts up his hand. Donald Turnbull. Turnbull, that's something I can relate to. Are you Donald? I don't know. I never called Donald in my life. I was Donnie or Don or Hey You or whatever. And she said, how stupid are you anyway? And that began my lifelong fight with teachers, I guess, and authority. So, having said all that, my parents aren't alcoholics. My grandparents, probably for religious convictions, were not drinkers at all. So who knows what they were or weren't. And I remember that first drink. I was off. I loved it. And, you know, going through high school, I got mediocre grades. I didn't know how to study. I was a good reader. Apparently I was fairly intelligent and dumb and very dumb at the same time. And, you know, comes time to go to college, I had fair marks. I went to the local university. Parents didn't have a lot of money, so I, you know, stayed at home, didn't have the college experience. But I set out to have my own college experience. In the second year of college, that's when drinking really started to take off. And I won't bore you with those kinds of details. I think most of you have been there and done that. But along the way, you know, I liked athletics. I grew a bunch. You saw me walking around earlier and learned how to play basketball a little bit. Now, basketball up there is not played at the level it was even down here in 1960. You know, hockey was the game, but I kept working at it, you know, made the varsity team finally and all that kind of stuff. There were no scholarships at that point in the university system I was in. And I thought I wanted to be a dentist. That sounded like a good idea. And the marks didn't happen. And slowly that became a pattern. My father finally yelled at me one day, why are you going to school to find out what you don't want to be? And it was kind of like that. But somewhere along the line, this is really weird now, chemistry and biochemistry came easily to me. I don't have any idea why. And so I started taking these biochemistry classes and took them all because they were easy. I was able to keep my marks up, play basketball, got my degree, took a year of graduate classes. I didn't do very well at that. And got a job at the local hospital working in the lab. And this was really, again, weird. When I interviewed for the job, the guy said, well, I've got two jobs available. One is a research chemist. You really don't have the degree for that. And the other was a chief technologist. He said, I got two women that qualify, but the one has no interest in it. They wouldn't be good at it anyway. And the other one doesn't have the education. What do you think of that? Well, sign me up. That's not good enough. And so I got hired as this chief tech. And working in this lab, automation in the lab up until that time, you know, test tubes and boiling, you know, think about Frankenstein's lab or something. That's just about the way things were done. And machines were coming into being, and they were automating the way tests were done. One person could, you know, run dozens and dozens of tests per hour. And being from the farm and having an aptitude for machinery and stuff, I could keep these machines running. Now, the girls were pissed when I got hired over everybody else. But soon they fell in love with me because they were staffed to do these tests manually. And along comes a guy that can make the machines work and teach them how to do it. And now they can sit around for 50 minutes out of the hour smoking cigarettes and having coffee. And so that was a lot of fun. And student lab techs, student nurses, student x-ray techs, nurses. I found out I had another addiction, which we won't go into. Were developed into another addiction. And met my first wife at a hospital dance. She was an x-ray tech. And one thing led to another, and we'll get into that a little later too. But I was working in the lab late one night, and a sales rep came from an American company came along, and he saw my motorcycle helmet sitting on this machine. Oh, yeah, motorcycle? Yeah, as we started shooting, you know, the crap. And he said, we're looking for a guy. Should be a guy because we don't think a woman could handle it. To cover Western Canada from the Lakehead to Victoria, from the American border to as far north as they have hospitals. Ooh, yeah. What does it pay? Long story short again, I got the job. They moved me to Vancouver, which is like taking a kid off the farm and saying, would you like to live in Haight-Ashbury for a while? Would I? Moved to Vancouver, got a probably about a 25% raise, a company car, and almost all my customers were women. They had offices in Toronto, 4,500 miles away or something, and their head office is in Hialeah, Florida, which is another 2,000 or 3,000 miles away. And so there wasn't a whole lot of accountability. And anyway, went on my merry way. I had credit cards and expense account and lots of dinners, lots of entertaining. So my alcoholic tendencies were developed on somebody else's dime. I didn't have to pay for it. I didn't put myself broke. I didn't really like drinking in bars anyway. But the company was expanding into another field, which was biochemistry. And they had a machine, and I started writing. I did not know of restraint of pen and tongue then, and it took me a while to find out about it, actually. Then I started writing memos, more or less saying, how crazy can you be that you would design something this way when blah, blah, blah. And finally they got tired of it, and they said, you think you can help us out? Come on down. I got moved to Toronto, and then I got moved out of Miami in 1974, and I've been in the States ever since. And so that's how I came to be with my foot in America. Now, the company I went to work for, anybody watch Mad Men back in the... Well, the company I went to work for was Mad Men. Mad stood for Madison Avenue, but that's what it was like. Everybody had the best-looking secretary they could find, and they all had lower scruples than anybody could even think of. Every boss had a credenza was full of liquor or a cart right behind their desk. Two or three martini lunches were not unheard of. And work hard and play hard. And I quite enjoyed that part. And so my alcoholic tendencies were fed. And so that went on from 1974 till 1979-80. And what happened is it was a privately owned company. Two guys owned the whole thing. And they developed a principle by which they could count blood cells electronically. I'll just leave it at that. And they made more money than they could shake a stick at really fast. So the guys that were on the ground floor that started with them more or less got raised up. And then all of a sudden they were roaring, raging alcoholics. And they started dying off one way or another, falling out of the back of a pickup truck going down the road, all kinds of things like that. One guy's wife committed suicide. And all of a sudden those guys were gone. And they got serious about realizing that this wasn't mom and pop anymore. They had a multi-million dollar a year company on their hands, and they probably needed some professional help, and which they brought in. And the guy that came into sales and marketing was an MBA graduate from Yale, and he had had experience with two or three companies in our industry. And he took a look around and quickly realized that I was not really pulling my weight, as it were. and used the analogy of musical chairs. You know, we're all dancing around, the music stopped and they took my chair away, and I'm still dancing, and everybody else is sitting down in their chair, following the new rules and the new order. And those of you that were around at that point in time, there was a book out called The Peter Principle. So we may hear a chuckle. This guy, Dr. Peters, came up with this idea of management, that a person raises to their level of competence in a company, and then they stay there. Well, that doesn't happen now. They raise to your level of competence, and you're out the door. But at that point, I had raised my level of competence, and so they gave me a job out in the field, back out in the field, maybe an offer. And then one thing led to another, and I ended up back in management in Atlanta in 1981. Starting all over, and looking back during my fourth step, I started to see a pattern. It happened at the hospital, it happened in my early days with Coulter, later days. I get this new job or a new area of responsibility, got really excited about it, dug in, did really well, got raised up the ladder, got a little bit tired of that, the drinking started taking off, and then I was staying ahead of myself somehow, and they give me another job somewhere else. And I get really excited about that, 3-5 months or so, and then slowly start tipping them back, spending more time drinking than working this job. And that little cycle followed me around about 4 times. So I'm working in the office in Marietta, and before all my indiscretions with the fairer sex were, you know, love them and leave them type thing, but I got involved with this one woman, and that was not a good thing to do. My wife found out about it. She didn't know what to do about it. She was from Canada too, and we had kids, and she was afraid, you know, to call my bluff, that, you know, she'd be left to fend for herself. So she ended up being really passive aggressive. You know, she's a trained X-ray tech. She got a job as a hostess at one of the watering holes. In fact, it was called Cheers, and that was exactly what it was like. It was in Roswell. If you remember the place, maybe you met her one night. I don't know. So she suggested we go to marriage counseling one time. Nah. A year later, I thought, well, maybe we better try marriage counseling. We went to marriage counseling, and it was okay as long as they were looking at me, but as soon as it was, you know, time to turn it on her, she didn't want anything to do with it. She bailed. And anyway, one thing led to another. You know, the boss was on my butt by then. All kinds of things were going on. I wasn't performing well. Some of the things I did were causing problems within the company, stuff like that. They were wondering if I was, padding the expense account. Answer was yes, but I was pretty good at hiding it. I called it creative writing, and quite common in the industry, I think. And one time I was in New York, and I phoned home several times. She didn't answer the phone. Went to Chicago, phoned home. A babysitter answered at 1 o'clock in the morning. And so she realized who it was, she hung up, and I kept phoning back. 4 o'clock in the morning, no answer, so on. Well, about 3 weeks before that, we had these outrageous Halloween parties in the neighborhood. And they started off pretty funny. The first one, she was pregnant, and she went as this pumpkin, you know, jack-o'-lantern, and she dressed me up like Peter Peter. Guys don't know that nursery rhyme? No. Okay. The last time, she dressed me up like a fire hydrant, and she went as a poodle. So she was known at that point that the jig was up, I guess. The next door neighbor lady talked to me, and she said, "Don, you don't look like you're having a good time." Nope. And it was the first time that I drank and drank and drank and didn't have a good time. I drank all the fun out of liquor. I was having a miserable time. All I was doing is walking around slurring my words and stumbling. She said, "You need to look at your own house. You're not the only thing that's a problem here." Oh. So I went to Radio Shack, and I got one of these devices where you could record phone calls. Hooked it into my phone, and off I went on that trip to New York and Chicago. And when I came home Thursday night, got the tape, listened to it on the way to work on Friday morning. And it turns out she was doing everything I was doing. And, you know, what can I say? But it was a crisis for me. And this is where I can first realize God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Now, I didn't know that phrase then, but I was to learn it probably the next week, I guess. I've been seeing a shrink again. Pardon me, the same person that we've been seeing before. I kept going because I got a little bit of calmness or whatever from this lady. And I tried to call her because I knew I was in a crisis. I was a mess. And she had gone home, wherever that was, New York or something, for Thanksgiving. And she had a guy covering for her. So I called him. Now, our office is in Marietta. The guy she had in her office was over in Dunwoody. And the guy she had covering with her had his office was about a mile from where my office was. He had just had a cancellation and called me back. He said, "Can you be here in 5 minutes?" I said, "I think so." He said, "Okay." I went over there. Told him a little bit about myself, and he said, "Well, tell me who Don Turnbull is, where he grew up, what he does for excitement, and so on." So I started to tell him doing the first step story, like they do in rehabs. And he listened for a while, and he said, "I got a question for you." "Okay. Is your life fucked up?" Pardon my French. This is a medical term because he said it. "Is your life fucked up because you drink and do drugs? Or you drink and do drugs because your life is fucked up?" Or maybe he had it the other way around. Doesn't matter. I sat there it felt like about 3 years. I started to cry. I said, "I have no idea, but I hurt so bad that I'm willing to look at this from any which way." And he said, "Well, you're in luck." He said, "We can teach you some skills by which you don't need to rely on drinks and drugs and other things to satisfy you and to fulfill you." And he went on to tell me about Ridgeview. Another thing, Ridgeview the week before had a big write-up on the front page of the Atlanta Journal where a guy had hung himself and was missing for 3 or 5 days. And I didn't even seem to know he was missing. So, of course, guys that were going to Ridgeview, because their medical board or whatever was sending them there from Washington or Minneapolis or wherever, they used that as an excuse not to go, and there was openings there where usually it was a 3 to 5 month wait. So, okay, I phoned my boss. He said, "Do whatever you want to do. We'll make sure Anna and the kids are looked after." So you think that would be enough of God doing for me what I needed to do, couldn't do for myself, but it wasn't finished. I go home. My future ex-wife-to-be was not there. And so I decided to find out what it was that she had gotten up in the drawer that she was telling her friend about, because Leroy or whoever it was coming over that weekend, next weekend. And she had the silly bastard me fix the hot tub so she could screw his brains out. That, you know, I was hearing, that's the kind of stuff I was hearing. And on that tape. And so I was going through her drawer, and she had come home. And she saw me in this drawer where there was underwear with pieces missing in it that I'd never seen before, and jumped on my back and started hammering me, telling her, mind my own business, get out of her stuff. And I went like that. I'm a big guy, she's not that big, and she went flying across the room and landed on this couch thing and fell to the ground moaning and everything, and yelled at the kids to phone the police, phone the police. And she gathered up the kids and left. So I went downstairs, I'm writing out the checks. It's about the end of the month, I'm writing the checks for the mortgage and for the electricity. And ding dong, two cops. We're looking for a Mr. Turnbull. Yes. Is that you, Donald Turnbull? Yes. He said, well, we found your wife on the side of the road with two broken ribs, unable to drive, and they took her to the hospital in an ambulance, and a friend came and took your kids to their place. Now, we've been doing this for a while, and we know that there's two sides to every story, and we'd like to hear yours. Now, whereas it's 2024, that wouldn't happen. You're going to jail, and we'll sort it out later. But this is 1987. So I told them, you know, everything except the drug part in her drawer. They said, well, we do have some discretion with this, but if you're going to Ridgeview, we suggest you get in your car and do not stop till you get there. If we ever come back to this house again, you're going to jail. I got the message that time. If there had been any doubt or equivocation in my mind that maybe I could skate by one more time or do something, I went into Ridgeview. And 2 days later, I picked up my first and only white chip, which is a miracle, yet another miracle. I used to call these things coincidences. I had all kinds of coincidences in my life, like those cops coming and stuff. But now they're miracles. And like I said, the only thing I've done 100% right in the 37 years it's been is I did not pick up a drink or a drug. And then along the way, when I was in there, I just digressed briefly, walked in one time to this men's session. The guy had written, infidelity equals relapse. Let's talk about it, gentlemen. Well, shit, I don't want to hear that. You know, you took away booze, you took away drugs, you take away almost all my fun, and now you want to do that too. So I'm arguing with them as it was my want. And finally, the guy had enough. He said, fine, don't worry about it. You go try it, you know, we'll still be here if you make it back. You have better things to teach us. So I started thinking about that, and I've been monogamous ever since. And that is maybe even more of a miracle than staying sober or not shoplifting, or I had isms like crazy. So that was the start of my sobriety, and it was a long road to hoe. She pretended that she was interested in my recovery and such until it got to the point where I was working again, and then sent a policeman to serve me my divorce papers one day in my office. I think they humiliate me. She thought apparently that the courts were there to punish, you know, the errant husband, and really all they care about is divvying up the loot and making sure the kids are looked after, which is the way it should be. But I was deathly afraid that she was going to take those kids, which had become really important to me, and run back to Canada, run back to her daddy. And but that never did happen. But I maybe it didn't happen because I worried about it. But one of my favorite sayings is that faith is hope with a track record. And I had hoped, I even prayed, even though I didn't start to hear about this God thing, which I had no clue about. But if prayer was going to help, I was going to pray. That, you know, I was going to be around, those kids were going to be around through my recovery and through their maturation process. And I'm glad to say that I ended up getting married. She had two kids and I had three, and we've got 10 grandchildren, and we've been married for 34 years, or pardon me, 32 years, and life is good that way. Just another thing this program of the 12 steps have given me. I went down to this sales meeting shortly afterwards, thinking I was going to get promoted because they were doing away with this product line, going to concentrating more on the core business. And, you know, nothing wrong with my ego. And I go down there and they tell me that, you know, Don, while you were gone, we farmed out all your duties to these other guys. We found your job actually went smoother when you weren't here. So we've done away with your job. And by the way, would you like a territory in, I can't even remember. One was New Jersey, and another one was Knoxville. And no, I didn't. And I went home. I'm about 3 months sober now, 4 months. And I thought it through. I had sent out, and this is another blow to my ego, I sent out about 40 letters to headhunters. That's the way things were done in those days. Explaining all my virtues and talents and skills, did not get one response. Not one. But I knew I couldn't leave those kids, and for my sake, and I even hoped it was for their sake. So, as I said before, it was a privately owned company, and I wrote the gentleman that owned it, and I said, for the first time in 13 years, I'm putting my needs ahead of those of the company. And I'm respectfully tendering my resignation. It's been a great ride. Licked the stamp, put it in the mailbox, slept really well. 2 days later, I got a phone call from the operations manager, and he said, Joe Colder gave me the letter you wrote him and told me to find you a job. And we're prepared to let you stay at Atlanta, you know, until you get your feet on the ground, your head on straight, and keep the company car, cut your salary in half. That was my net salary, you know, including commissions and all that. Doing a programming job of my own on the side, ended up doing that for quite a while. And so that all worked out. So now I had some hopes, and now I've got this faith. Because a couple times this faith business has paid off and things are working out. Eventually, I guess it's about a year, year and a half later, I wrote this program for entering this stuff into all the sales quotes and things. And that job was over, and they offered me a territory, some things that opened up around Atlanta, and I took that. And that was kind of a blow to the ego after being a national sales manager and things like that, traveling all over the country, you know. So now I've been sober about 3 years. One day I made a sales call in the Medical College of Georgia. And here's this nice young lady there. And gosh, one thing led to another. And got confused and sold the wrong thing. And we got married within about 4 or 5 months after that. And we're still married. And from my point of view, and I believe hers, very happily married. You know, life hasn't been a bed of roses for me, or for us. My eldest son, who was born in 1977, was so much like me, I said I didn't know whether to hug him or hit him. He used the term manic depressive when he was about 12 months old, you'd be laughing and rolling around the floor, and the next minute he'd be just throwing a temper tantrum. You know, so there's not a doubt in my mind he was bipolar. And the ex-wife, she, we tried everything. And we worked together. Put him out here to Riverside. Kicked him out of Riverside. One thing after another, drinking, drugging, lying. He was a schemer. He was a manipulator. Here's kind of a funny story. Parent teacher thing comes along. Of course, I'm not there because I'm traveling. And she goes in and she said, you know, Graham is such a fun kid. He said, but you people are saints. Boy, taking him in like that. Well, you know, after the fire and his parents dying, getting burned to death. Oh, come on. And then there was the other day when it was show and tell, and he obviously had forgotten his thing, so he got up and he said, well, you know, we moved up here from Florida, and in Florida I had a pet alligator. His name is Chomps. But now Chomps has gotten big, and we got to keep him staked in the backyard, so I couldn't bring him. You know, and that's the kind of stuff that came out of him. Well, again, a long story short, he died of a drug overdose in 2011. And that was hard. I learned to pray during that time. I probably learned to pray properly at that time, and my prayer was, as well past, fix him, take him off my hands, let me fix him, whatever. And it was, give me strength to endure whatever you've got in store for him. And that prayer got me through without drinking or drugging, burying him. Not a fun time at all. His mother died about 3 years before. It turns out she was an alcoholic with problems of her own. No wonder we couldn't get along, you know? My prayers when I was in rehab there is, let us get back together. You know, so we could, I know it's wrong now. It's me. I've done all this. I got all this guilt. I know it's me. I know it's wrong. I'm going to be good now, and everything will work out. Looking back, if I'd moved back into that house with her, I would not have 34 years of sobriety. I don't know how many years I would have had, but I doubt seriously that I would have this much longevity in the program. So God does for me and continues to do for me what I can't do for myself. Then there's a God thing. So I grew up on this farm. Unmarried, divorced women up there in the early 30s were to be scorned at. They were obviously loose women, low morals or whatever. And my dad lived in this community and married this woman, and he kind of got shunned. And that pissed him off, and he swore off church, and that was it. And now up there, they don't have the separation of church and state, so we'd have these stories every morning, you know, out of the books, Goliath and David and Goliath, I mean, and Hercules, and all these different things. So I had a little bit of knowledge of some of this, and who Jesus was, and all that, you know, and away in a manger, and all those kinds of things. But it wasn't a real God. It wasn't, I don't know, it was just stories in a book. So one day, this is the beginning of my spiritual growth. One day, they would give us a task. And this one, I had to write one on the death of my best friend, Roman Coke, and how to mourn him. And this guy was, you can't short-arm God. He was a Golden Glove boxing champion in the Navy. He was a guy like me with, 38 inch arms, and explained what it was. And he had a daughter who was killed in a car accident. He'd go up and drink and keep going around the same curve faster and faster and faster, trying to figure out how fast they were going before they rolled this car that killed his daughter. And he said, "I am so mad at God." "You're mad at God? That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard." And all of a sudden I said, "You're so mad at God, you won't even admit he exists." And I zoned out probably for the rest of the day. That was the start of my spiritual awakening, sort of a burning bush thing. And life has gone on from that point, high spots, low spots. Not the errant son, but the other four kids got degrees at university and raising kids of their own. And I'm Pops, because that's the most irreverent name I could think of to be called. And they like me, and I like them. And when my son had his first kid, he's 2 years old, he's 16 now, so say 14 years ago, they asked us if we'd look after him for the weekend. Now, this is a kid that would not come and see me in rehab, because the last time he saw me, his mother was taken to the hospital in an ambulance, and he had to be forced to come and see me in rehab. I said, "I really appreciate you trusting me to look after your son." He looked at me like I was crazy. "Dad, there's nobody I'd rather have looking after my son than you." Oh, heart be still, So these are the kinds of positive things that happen. I mean, I guess by world standards, we're considered well off. We live in a nice house and have nice things and that, but we're truly happy, my wife and I, and, oobla-dee, oobla-da, life goes on, I wake up in the morning, and I'm not that good at praying in the morning. I do quite a bit better at night. As we were meeting earlier here, we talked about gratitude. I'm very grateful. I'm just so very grateful. I don't have any trouble now figuring out what I'm grateful for. That's an easy one. So, with that, thanks for your attention, and we'll call it an evening. I guess you've heard that adage, every time you're hearing this, if you're going to speak, there's three different speeches: the one you're going to give, the one you give, and the one you meant to give. So you can figure out which one you got.
Good job. Thank you, Don.
First I slip, and then I crib to a hope-filled dream. Rescue me, and finally, waken there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promise. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Thank you. Take me where the promise.